Now, we may not be accustomed to thinking of the Bible in this way, but essentially it's the story of a cosmic war. That's what it narrates as it proceeds from Genesis to Revelation. It narrates a cosmic war. And that's what we're focusing on then. In our Sunday evening sermons just now, we're working our way through five main phases of this cosmic war. And last week we went back almost to the beginning of the Bible, and we located the origins of this cosmic war in a coup carried out by Satan. In his pride, you remember, Satan resented God's position of supremacy in this universe, and so he launched a devastating attack on God, targeting God's noblest creation, man, managing to bring man, and with man the rest of creation, crashing down. We saw, however, that confronted with this situation, God doesn't meekly concede defeat. On the contrary, he issues a defiant statement. He says effectively, "Right, Satan, now that you have so brazenly challenged my rule and my authority, this means war. This means cosmic war." And so our title last week was "The Conflict Commences in the Coup." Our title this evening is "The Conflict Continues Over the Centuries." The conflict continues over the centuries. And I mean by that then the centuries of Old Testament history. You don't have to be an expert in the Old Testament to know that it contains an awful lot of conflicts. You have the story of the Exodus. And what is it? Well, it's God's people being liberated from a nation, Egypt, that had God's people in bondage. So it's a situation of conflict. You have the journey of God's people following the Exodus toward the Promised Land. And that journey involved God's people at different points fighting battles involved in conflicts. You have the eventual conquest of the Promised Land, the removal of the native Canaanite population. And by definition then, that is conflict. You have the period of the judges, and time and again during that period, God's people spend several years under foreign domination until by God's grace another judge emerges to rescue them. It's a recurring cycle of conflicts. You have the inauguration of monarchy within God's people, the reigns of Saul and David, and those kings are constantly having to engage in military campaigns, in particular because the Philistines are a constant thorn in their side. It's yet more conflict. You have the era of the prophets, and in those days, the great superpowers of Assyria and Babylon emerge on the world scene, throwing their weight about and bullying easy targets like God's little people there in Israel. Once again, it's conflicts. You have the culmination of that era in the deportation of God's people to a far-off land, to Babylon. And that's conflict, all right. You have the subsequent return of the exiles and the attempts to rebuild Jerusalem. And it's a project plagued by the attempts of hostile forces to stymie the whole thing. Plagued, in other words, by conflicts. You have, during that same period, the prophecies of Daniel that we've considered recently on Sunday evenings, looking ahead to the Greek Empire, and in particular to Antiochus Epiphanes, who you remember would wreak unprecedented devastation on God's people. That is to say, Daniel was foretelling horrible conflict. And so you get the picture then. And I want to ask this evening, what should we make of this unrelenting conflict that's written so large across the pages of the Old Testament? What is it? What's it all about? And I want to suggest then three things in answer to that question. First of all, it's the enmity occurring. It's the enmity occurring. So remember, in his defiant response to Satan's coup, There in the Garden of Eden, God speaks those justly famous words that we know as Genesis 3:15. And the first line of Genesis 3:15 goes like this. God is addressing the serpent, he's addressing Satan, and he says, "I will put enmity between you and the woman." And we said then that from now on, Eve would no longer, as it were, eat out of Satan's hand as she had done over those few fateful minutes of their conversation in the garden. Then she had allowed him to wrap her around his little finger. She'd put up virtually no resistance to him whatsoever. But God was going to graciously do something in Eve's heart now. He was going to implant within her a loathing of Satan, a loathing of the serpent. Doubtless Satan would still harass Eve often, but he wouldn't find in her now that ready compliance that he had found in her on that day. She would stand up to him now. There would be an enmity between the two of them. That's what the first line of Genesis 3:15 means. But then the verse carries on, and you have that next line where God says, "And between your offspring," speaking, remember, to the serpent, "between your offspring and her offspring." In other words, Eve was going to have offspring. She was going to have descendants who would also be harassed and would also, because of the gracious work of God in their hearts, stand up to it. The difference would be that instead of being harassed directly by Satan himself, these descendants of Eve would be harassed by Satan's offspring. Who are Satan's offspring? Well, not literal biological children that Satan bears, but rather human beings who belong to him, human beings who are on his side. And this phenomenon then, intimated there in the second line of Genesis 3:15, it very quickly manifests itself, doesn't it, on the stage of history. You go to the very next chapter of Genesis, and you have there the story of Cain and Abel. Preachers, you know, into commentaries, if you ever get two preachers together, it won't be long before the question arises, you know, what commentary have you used on this, but what commentary do you think is the best one on this part of scripture, and so on. Well, there's a fantastic commentary on the story of Cain and Abel, but it's not from the pen of John Calvin or Matthew Henry or Don Carson. It's from the pen of the Apostle John. It's in 1 John 3 verse 12, and there John comments on that Genesis 4 narrative, and he makes two very important points about it. So for one thing, he very clearly connects the Cain and Abel incident with that second line of Genesis 3:15. He says that Cain was of the evil one. So he confirms then that what happens in Genesis 4, it's an eruption of that enmity between Satan's offspring and Eve's offspring. Abel was Eve's offspring. Biologically, of course, Cain was also Eve's offspring, but in this deeper sense, he was Satan's offspring. He was on Satan's side. He was of the evil one. But the other interesting thing that John does in that verse, in 1 John 3 verse 12, is this. He probes the psychological dimension, if you like, of the relationship between Cain and Abel. And yes, Cain belonged to the evil one, but nonetheless, Cain had his own personal motive in doing what he did. He wasn't some kind of mindless robot who had been programmed by Satan. Now, what does John say? He says he murdered him because his own deeds were evil and his brother's righteous. John Stott says jealousy lay behind his hatred. The jealousy which resents another's superior righteousness. And really then, all the clashes and battles that follow throughout the remainder of the Old Testament, those ones that I quickly went through a moment ago in my introduction, really, they're all just an extension then of the same phenomenon that we see erupting first there in Genesis 4 between Cain and Abel. Again and again throughout the Old Testament, you have the nations of the ancient Near East getting at Israel, harassing Israel. And it's this enmity then, the enmity foretold in the second line of Genesis 3:15, the enmity exhibited in the episode of Cain and Abel. Cain and Abel, it's that enmity occurring. It's the seed of the serpent coming up against the seed of the woman Eve. And doubtless that psychological dimension that we just mentioned, that John brings out in 1 John 3:12, doubtless that is often at work as this conflict rumbles on throughout the Old Testament. And you have then those nations of the ancient Near East, and they are nations that worshipped idols, and they sacrificed their children in the flames, and they engaged in sacred prostitution and a whole load of other forms of sexual debauchery. And they saw Israel then, and of course, far too often, much of Israel wasn't all that much different. But there was always a remnant, at least, of Israel that was different. In the Judges period, there were men like Boaz. In Ahab's period, there were 7,000 who hadn't bowed the knee to Baal. And as the nations then saw that righteous Israelite remnant living so differently from them, and not worshipping idols, but worshipping the true God, and being pure and holy in sexual conduct. As the nation saw that in Israel, it prodded their consciences, because as Paul says in Romans 2, the law was written on their hearts. It prodded their consciences and it hit a raw nerve within them. And they recognized, like Cain recognized in Abel, that the Israelites had a superior righteousness. And they were jealous. And like Cain then, they resorted to violence and getting at Israel and taking up arms against God's people. I'm saying then this in the first place this evening, this unrelenting conflict on page after page of the Old Testament. It's the enmity occurring. The enmity foretold there in the Garden of Eden. The enmity between Satan's offspring and Eve's offspring. An enmity at the heart of which, we may infer from 1 John 3:12, is this burning resentment in the seed of the serpent. This burning resentment against the superior righteousness that they see in the seed of Eve. So it's the enmity occurring. But then notice with me, secondly, what is this conflict? It's the serpent panicking. It's the serpent panicking. So we read this evening from Revelation 12, just that little snippet of the chapter, 4 verses, and in those verses then we have two main characters. There's a great red dragon, and we know who that is. We're told just a little bit later in verse 9 of the same chapter that the dragon is the ancient serpent, who is called the devil and Satan. So the dragon is Satan. That's one main character. The other main character in Revelation 12 there is a woman. And the woman is clearly God's Old Testament people. Notice how she's kind of wrapped up in the sun and the moon and the stars. That's an allusion to Joseph's dream back in Genesis 37, where you remember the sun represents Jacob, and the moon represents Rachel, and the stars represent the brothers, the 12 brothers. There are 11 stars bowing down to Joseph, but the stars are the brothers. And so together then, the sun, moon and stars in Genesis 37, they represent the foundation of God's Old Testament people. And this woman here, she's wrapped up in the sun and moon and stars, and it's saying to us that this is God's Old Testament people. That's what the woman represents. So those are the two main characters. You've got Satan, and you've got God's Old Testament people, and clearly they're in conflict. Verse 4 depicts the dragon assaulting the woman with his tail. So it's highly pictorial stuff, as you would expect, in the book of Revelation, but it's fairly obvious, isn't it? This is the same theme again that we've been talking about already this evening. This is the enmity between Eve's offspring and the serpent's offspring. And okay, here it seems to be that it's more directly Satan himself who is getting at God's people rather than Satan's offspring, Satan's human agents. But we needn't expect kind of great theological precision in the picture language here. It's essentially the same phenomenon. It's the two lines. It's these two camps against each other, Satan's descendants and Eve's descendants. But here, there's an additional dimension. A further reason is given why God's people are being repeatedly assaulted. We've already said that in the mind of Satan's human agents, there's this jealousy, there's this resentment of a superior righteousness. But in Satan's mind, there's something else going on in this ongoing conflict. As a crucial detail, we're given in verse 2. The woman is pregnant. The woman is pregnant. What does that mean? Well, remember the last part of Genesis 3:15. Remember that someone, it is said there, God says there, someone is going to come from God's people and is going to reverse the coup and is going to defeat utterly the perpetrator of the coup, Satan. We perhaps imagine sometimes when we read Genesis 3, we imagine Adam and Eve walking out of that garden at the end of the chapter, and we try to kind of psychoanalyze Adam and Eve and imagine what was going through their minds and what it was like for them, having lived in Eden, having lived with God in Eden, walked with him in Eden, what it was like for them to walk out of that sanctuary at the end of that chapter. We perhaps don't think so much what it was like for the serpent to slither out of that sanctuary at the end of Genesis 3. We don't psychoanalyze him so much. But he must have left that garden that day with those words at the end of Genesis 3:15, haunting him, mustn't he? Reverberating around his head. He must have left that garden, unable to think of anything other than this fact that from the people of God, a slayer was going to emerge who would finish him off. And he must then have lived throughout the ensuing years and decades and centuries in a state of perpetual agitation and panic. My slayer is going to come. My slayer is going to come from this people, this seed of the woman. My slayer, my skull crusher is going to come. In this weather, you know what it's like. You're sitting out in the garden and you feel something touch your hair, or you just hear a faint noise somewhere and you're convinced there's a wasp. You may be right, you may not be right, but you start kind of thrashing around and you can't see the thing, you don't even know for sure it's there, but you're just kind of crazily hitting out at this wasp in panic. And there's a sense then, I think, in which that is what's happening in all these battles throughout the rest of the Old Testament. It's Satan panicking at the thoughts of his slayer emerging from this people. And so he's lashing out wildly at this people, trying to desperately terminate the pregnancy, stop this conqueror from coming from this people. Cut off the channel, cut off the pipeline from which the conqueror is going to emerge. And of course, the wonderful thing is that he failed. He failed. And let me just pause for a moment on that point and apply it. I mean, we're going to follow this conflict through in this little series to its end. And at the risk of dropping in a major spoiler, God is going to win. And he's going to win in the fullest sense. He's going to win back this universe from Satan. He's going to completely win it back from the enemy who tried to wrest it from his grasp. And in fact, more than that, he's going to win it back in such a way, I think we can say, that he will ultimately win more glory to himself than if it had never been invaded by Satan in the first place. Than if there'd never been a coup. Which is to say that, like pretty much everything Satan does, his most basic action, that coup in the Garden of Eden, proves counterproductive. It actually only serves to bring more glory and more praise and more honor to God. God is going to win. God is going to completely overturn the situation. God's not just going to salvage something from the wreckage. God is going to win this conflict. But here we are tonight, and we might find that really quite hard to believe. Because we look out on a world where Satan's fingerprints seem to be everywhere, don't they? A world where he really does seem, as Paul describes him, to be the god of this age. Whereas the Apostle John again puts it in his first epistle, a world which really does seem to lie in the evil one. That's what John writes in the Greek. And we look at this world then, and we think, is God really going to win? Or is Satan going to win? Is Satan going to have the victory after all? But this is the thing, you see. If God, and I'm obviously speaking in human terms here, but if God was ever going to lose this conflict, the point at which surely he was going to lose it was this phase that we're thinking about this evening. Those centuries of Old Testament history. I mean, think about it. Satan had there a window of about 3,000 years from the Garden of Eden. He knows with increasing accuracy, because of the promises of God, where this slayer of his is going to come from. Going to come from the people of God, but of course that will be narrowed down further later on. Going to come from the house of David. And it's a pretty fragile channel, isn't it, that this conqueror is going to come from. I mean, the genes that are going to finally make up this conqueror are, over those centuries, dispersed across a whole load of very ordinary, very obscure, very anonymous human beings. The pipeline seems very, very fragile, very, very tenuous. I mean, how hard can it be, you might think, for Satan to terminate this pregnancy, for Satan to stop this conqueror being born? Surely, with so much time at his disposal, and with the woman being so gettable, surely he's going to do it. Surely this is where he's going to overturn the whole thing. And yet, you see, even in this phase, where things seem most favorable for him, even during this phase, he can't get the better of God. He does some damage through these battles, and that's the significance of the swiping of his tail in verse 4, bringing down a third of the stars of heaven. The stars, remember we said, are the tribes of Israel. And so you know how these fractions in Revelation work. And when it says then that he kind of damaged a third of the tribes of Israel, we're not to think of that kind of with numerical accuracy. But the point is that it was a significant proportion without being the whole thing by any means. That's the point. So he did some damage. And of course we know, don't we, from our Old Testaments that at times he seemed to come very close to terminating the pregnancy. During the days of Haman, when a date has been set for the annihilation of all the Jewish people, during the days of Antiochus Epiphanes, when he wreaked such havoc, at times he seems to come close, but he fails. He fails. When things are most favorably disposed for Satan, when he has his best opportunity, he fails. Such is the undefeatableness, such is the invincibility of our God. And that's why we don't need to worry tonight. As we look forward now and we wonder, is God going to win? We're talking about this God, the God of Old Testament history, the God who kept that red dragon from ever managing to abort the conqueror in the womb of Israel. God knows how to win this conflict, and God will win, and you and I can be confident of nothing else like we can be confident of that this evening. So this conflict then, it's the enmity occurring, it's the serpent panicking. But then thirdly and finally, it's the future emerging. It's the future emerging. So the conflict then between these two seeds collectively, between Eve's offspring and Satan's offspring, in some way it's just kind of a phase of the whole thing that will then pass, and you'll have the actual individual showdown as the conqueror himself comes and takes on Satan himself. But there's slightly more to it than that, because I think we can say this, that as the conflict is going on during the Old Testament in its collective stage, and you've got kind of the descendants of Satan continually attacking the descendants of Eve, at that stage, repeatedly, there are previews and anticipations of the individual showdown that will occur. The way that the conflict is often won at this collective stage during the Old Testament, it often previews how the conflict will finally be won in that individual way once the conqueror emerges. And we could go to many places to demonstrate that, and we've been in relatively recent times in Judges, and we've seen this theme there. But just as we close tonight, let's think about it in relation to the other passage we read and the story of David and Goliath. Because I think we have it there. There, of course, Israel is being harassed by the Philistines. It's just another episode in this ongoing conflict of the Old Testament. But the way in which it's won, the way in which it's won by David, I think that faintly anticipates and previews the way in which the conqueror will win once he emerges. And just a few pointers in this connection then. Notice, first of all, David's identity. This slayer here, the champion of this passage who fells Goliath. His identity is so unlikely, isn't he? He's this obscure youth who turns up at the battlefield. And the brothers are annoyed that he's even there, that he's even talking about the whole thing. And then you remember when he's taken to Saul. Saul comments on his youthfulness. And then when he goes out to meet Goliath, Goliath laughs at his youthfulness. He's not obvious conquering material. Is that not a preview of the one who will be raised in Nazareth? Can any good thing come from Nazareth? The one whom Paul says was found in appearance as a man. The ordinary Jesus. He walked around and he didn't look like he was the one who was going to break the powers of hell. He was the one who was going to finally crush the head of the ancient serpent. He didn't seem obvious, serpent crushing, devil conquering material. And in the obscurity then of David's identity, the unlikeliness of it, we have a little preview of Jesus, the conqueror. David's identity, then again, David's empowerment. And this didn't come out in the section we read, but if you just go back to the previous chapter, 1 Samuel 16, where David is anointed as king, at the end of that very well-known narrative, there's a bit that's perhaps not so well-known. We kind of have lost interest by this point, but 1 Samuel 16, verse 13, Samuel takes the horn of oil and anoints him in the midst of his brothers. And then we read, the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon David from that day forward. He's anointed as king, and then the Spirit rushes on him. And we're meant to take that with us then into chapter 17. How on earth can he fell Goliath? Because he's empowered by the Spirit of God. And it's again a little preview of the one who will begin his public ministry by being baptized in the River Jordan, and the Spirit will come down upon him. And the writer to the Hebrews will later comment that it was by the eternal Spirit that he offered himself without blemish to God. He conquered Satan in the power of the Holy Spirit. David's identity, David's empowerment, David's method. We all know how he did it. In terms of the actual methodology, that it was through the sling and these stones, and it's so unconventional, isn't it? I mean, you don't defeat a Philistine giant with a sling and with stones. The bit I read finished there in verse 50, there was no sword in the hand of David. Well, that's how you kill warriors. You do it with a sword, but David doesn't do it with a sword. He does it in this strange way that no one would ever have thought possible. Again, surely a little anticipation of the one we considered this morning who will abolish death, not, we said, in the manner of Mr. Incredible, but by going into death. Hebrews again, by death he will destroy, or he did destroy, him who held the power of death. Such an unlikely way of doing it. David's identity, his empowerment, his method, and then lastly his attitude. What is David's attitude as he conquers Goliath? Well, it's how dare you defy God, isn't it? It's the glory of God that motivates. Not in the first instance the liberation of Israel. I'm sure that mattered to David, but that's not the primary concern. It's bringing glory to the God who has been insulted by this man. And again that comes across as he speaks before going into battle, and then as he addresses Goliath. This is what's on his mind. Again, a little anticipation of the conqueror who will conquer, driven by the glory of God, driven by anger against the sheer insolence of the enemy who brought about that coup. You get windows into that, don't you? Jesus in John 11 at the graveside in Bethany. I've talked of this before, and the way in which John tells us that Jesus was angry. Why is he angry at a funeral? His friend has died. We can understand him being sad, but why is he angry? He's angry because he's looking into the eyes of the monster who has so wrecked this world, this creation. He's angry with Satan. And Benjamin Warfield says that narrative is uncovering the heart of Jesus as later he goes to the cross. He goes to the cross in burning anger to defeat the defiant wretch Satan who has dared to invade God's creation. You see it in the prayer, don't you, that he taught his disciples to pray. And the way it begins, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. That's what drives Jesus. Yes, he wants to save you and me, but his primary concern is to win back the universe for God and for God's claims to be reasserted. And David just gives us a little inkling of that. And so, as we see this ongoing conflict and its different episodes, Samson as well, Gideon, we're seeing the future emerging. Just little windows into Jesus and his conquest. And remember Peter's surprising words in 1 Peter 1, where he talks about the Old Testament prophets prophesying Jesus. And he says something very surprising there. He says that they knew that they were not serving themselves, they were serving you. Now, you might think that surely the reason the prophets looked ahead to Jesus was to show their contemporaries Jesus, to show them this Saviour who was one day going to come. And I'm sure there's a little bit of that going on. But no, Peter says they were writing for your benefit, their prophecies. And we say, but we don't need them. We've got the Gospels. No, Peter says, you need them as well. You need the light that the prophets, the Old Testaments give us on Jesus. The New Testament doesn't give us enough on Jesus. You need what the Old Testament gives us on Jesus as well. We need 1 Samuel 17. We need this incident. We need to see Jesus through David in miniature, through Samson, through these warrior figures. They show us an angle on Jesus that perhaps we don't get quite so often in the Gospels, for instance. And so let's revel in these narratives. See our Saviour being trailered there, previewed there. And let's thank God with all our hearts tonight for our conqueror Jesus. Amen.